This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West by Blaine Hardin. This book is read by Blaine Hardin. For North Koreans who remain in the camps. There is no human rights issue in this country, as everyone leads the most dignified and happy life. North Korean Central News Agency, March 6, 2009. Preface: A Teachable Moment. His first memory is an execution. He walked with his mother to a wheat field near the Tadong River, where guards had rounded up several thousand prisoners. Excited by the crowd, the boy crawled between adult legs to the front row, where he saw guards tying a man to a wooden pole. Shin In-goon was 4 years old, too young to understand the speech that came before that killing. At dozens of executions in years to come, he would listen to a supervising guard telling the crowd that the prisoner about to die had been offered redemption through hard labor, but had rejected the generosity of the North Korean government. To prevent the prisoner from cursing the state that was about to take his life, guards stuffed pebbles into his mouth, then covered his head with a hood. At that first execution, Shin watched three guards take aim. Each fired three times. The reports of their rifles terrified the boy, and he fell over backward. But he scrambled to his feet in time to see guards untie a slack, blood-spattered body, wrap it in a blanket, and heave it into a cart. In Camp 14, a prison for the political enemies of North Korea, assemblies of more than two inmates were forbidden, except for executions. Everyone had to attend them. The labor camp used a public killing, and the fear it generated, as a teachable moment. Shin's guards in the camp were his teachers and his breeders. They had selected his mother and father. They taught him that prisoners who break camp rules deserve death. On a hillside near his school, a slogan was posted, "All according to the rules and regulations." The boy memorized the camp's 10 rules, the 10 commandments, as he later called them, and can still recite them by heart. The first one stated, "Anyone caught escaping will be shot immediately." 10 years after that first execution, Shin returned to the same field. Again, guards had rounded up a big crowd. Again, a wooden pole had been pounded in the ground. A makeshift gallows had also been built. Shin arrived this time in the back seat of a car driven by a guard. He wore handcuffs and a blindfold fashioned from a rag. His father, also handcuffed and blindfolded, sat beside him in the car. They had been released from 8 months in an underground prison inside Camp 14. As a condition of their release, they had signed documents promising never to discuss what had happened to them underground. In that prison within a prison, guards tried to torture a confession out of Shin and his father. They wanted to know about the failed escape of Shin's mother and only brother. Guards stripped Shin, tied ropes to his ankles and wrists, and suspended him from a hook in the ceiling. They lowered him over a fire. He passed out when his flesh began to burn. But he confessed nothing. He had nothing to confess. He had not conspired with his mother and brother to escape. He believed what guards had taught him since his birth inside the camp. He could never escape, and he must inform on anyone who talks about trying. Not even in his dreams had Shin fantasized about life on the outside. Guards never taught him what every North Korean schoolboy learns. Americans are bastards, scheming to invade and humiliate the homeland. South Korea is the bitch of its American master. North Korea is a great country whose brave and brilliant leaders are the envy of the world. Indeed, he knew nothing of the existence of South Korea, China, or the United States. Unlike his countrymen, he did not grow up with the ubiquitous photograph of his dear leader, as Kim Jong-il was called. Nor had he seen photographs or statues of Kim's father, Kim Il-sung, the great leader who founded North Korea and who remains the country's eternal president, despite his death in 1994. Although he had not been important enough for brainwashing, Shin had been schooled to inform on his family and on his classmates. He won food as a reward and joined guards in beating up children he betrayed. His classmates, in turn, tattled on him and beat him up. When a guard removed his blindfold, when he saw the crowd, the wooden pole, and the gallows, Shin believed he was about to be executed. No pebbles, though, were forced into his mouth. His handcuffs were removed. A guard led him to the front of the crowd. He and his father would be spectators. Guards dragged a middle-aged woman to the gallows and tied a young man to the wooden pole. They were Shin's mother and his older brother. A guard tightened a noose around his mother's neck. She tried to catch his eye. He looked away. After she stopped twitching at the end of the rope, Shin's brother was shot by three guards, each fired three times. As he watched them die, Shin was relieved it was not him. He was angry with his mother and brother for planning an escape. Although he would not admit it to anyone for 15 years, he knew he was responsible for their executions. Introduction. Never heard the word love. 9 years after his mother's hanging, Shin squirmed through an electric fence and ran off through the snow. It was January 2, 2005. Before then, no one born in a North Korean political prison camp had ever escaped. As far as can be determined, Shin is still the only one to do it. He was 23 years old and knew no one outside the fence. Within a month, he had walked into China. Within 2 years, he was living in South Korea. 4 years later, he was living in Southern California and was a senior ambassador at Liberty in North Korea, LINK, an American human rights group. In California, he rode his bike to work, followed the Cleveland Indians because of their South Korean slugger, Shin Soo Chu, and ate two or three times a week at In-N-Out Burger, which he viewed as the world's finest burger. His name is now Shin Dong-hyuk. He changed it after arriving in South Korea, an attempt to reinvent himself as a free man. He is handsome, with quick, wary eyes. A Los Angeles dentist has done work on his teeth, which he could not brush in the camp. His overall physical health is excellent. His body, though, is a roadmap of the hardships of growing up in a labor camp that the North Korean government insists does not exist. Stunted by malnutrition, he is short and slight, 5 feet 6 inches, about 120 pounds. His arms are bowed from childhood labor. His lower back and buttocks are scarred with burns from the torturer's fire. The skin over his pubis bears a puncture scar from the hook used to hold him in place over the fire. His ankles are scarred by shackles from which he was hung upside down in solitary confinement. His right middle finger is cut off at the first knuckle, a guard's punishment for dropping a sewing machine in a camp garment factory. His shins, from ankle to knee on both legs, are mutilated and scarred by burns from the electrified barbed wire fence that failed to keep him inside Camp 14. Shin is roughly the same age as Kim Jong-un, the chubby third son of Kim Jong-il, who took over as leader after his father's death in 2011. As contemporaries, Shin and Kim Jong-un personify the antipodes of privilege and privation in North Korea, a nominally classless society where, in fact, breeding and bloodlines decide everything. Kim Jong-un was born a communist prince and raised behind palace walls. He was educated under an assumed name in Switzerland and returned to North Korea to study in an elite university named after his grandfather. Because of his parentage, he lives above the law. For him, everything is possible. In 2010, he was named a 4-star general in the Korean People's Army, despite a total lack of field experience in the military. A year later, after his father died of a sudden heart attack, state media in North Korea described him as another leader sent from heaven. He may, however, be forced to share his earthly dictatorship with relatives and military leaders. Shin was born a slave and raised behind a high-voltage barbed wire fence. He was educated in a camp school to read and count at a rudimentary level. Because his blood was tainted by the perceived crimes of his father's brothers, he lived below the law. For him, nothing was possible. His state-prescribed career trajectory was hard labor and an early death from disease brought on by chronic hunger, all without a charge or a trial or an appeal, and all in secrecy. In stories of concentration camp survival, there is a conventional narrative arc. Security forces steal the protagonist away from a loving family and a comfortable home. To survive, he abandons moral principles, suppresses feelings for others, and ceases to be a civilized human being. In perhaps the most celebrated of these stories, Night, by Nobel Prize winner Elie Wiesel, the 13-year-old narrator explains his torment with an account of the normal life that existed before he and his family were packed aboard trains bound for Nazi death camps. Wiesel studied the Talmud daily. His father owned a store and watched over their village in Romania. His grandfather was always present to celebrate the Jewish holidays. But after the boy's entire family perished in the camps, Wiesel was left alone, terribly alone, in a world without God, without man, without love or mercy. Shin's story of survival is different. His mother beat him, and he viewed her as a competitor for food. His father, who was allowed by guards to sleep with his mother just 5 nights a year, ignored him. His brother was a stranger. Children in the camp were untrustworthy and abusive. Before he learned anything else, Shin learned to survive by snitching on all of them. Love and mercy and family were words without meaning. God did not disappear or die. Shin had never heard of him. In a preface to Night, Wiesel wrote that an adolescent's knowledge of death and evil should be limited to what one discovers in literature. In Camp 14, Shin did not know literature existed. He saw only one book in the camp, a Korean grammar, in the hands of a teacher who wore a guard's uniform, carried a revolver on his hip, and beat one of his primary school classmates to death with a chalkboard pointer. Unlike those who have survived a concentration camp, Shin had not been torn away from a civilized existence and forced to descend into hell. He was born and raised there. He accepted its values. He called it home. North Korea's labor camps have now existed twice as long as the Soviet Gulag and about 12 times longer than the Nazi concentration camps. There is no dispute about where these camps are. High-resolution satellite photographs, accessible on Google Earth to anyone with an internet connection, show vast, fenced compounds sprawling through the rugged mountains of North Korea. The South Korean government estimates there are about 154,000 prisoners in the camps, while the U.S. State Department and several human rights groups have put the number as high as 200,000. After examining a decade of satellite images of the camps, Amnesty International noticed new construction inside the camps in 2011 and became concerned that the inmate population was increasing, perhaps to short-circuit possible unrest as power began to shift from Kim Jong-il to his young and untried son. There are 6 camps, according to South Korea's intelligence agency and human rights groups. The biggest is 31 miles long and 25 miles wide, an area larger than the city of Los Angeles. Electrified barbed wire fences, punctuated by guard towers and patrolled by armed men, encircle most of the camps. 2 of them, numbers 15 and 18, have re-education zones where some fortunate detainees receive remedial instruction in the teachings of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. If prisoners memorize enough of these teachings and convince guards they are loyal, they can be released, but they are monitored for the rest of their lives by state security. The remaining camps are complete control districts, where prisoners who are called irredeemables are worked to death. Shin's camp, number 14, is a complete control district. By reputation, it is the toughest of them all because of its particularly brutal working conditions, the vigilance of its guards, and the state's unforgiving view of the seriousness of the crimes committed by its inmates, many of whom are purged officials from the ruling party, the government, and the military, along with their families. Established in 1959 in central North Korea, Kaechon, South Pyongan Province, Camp 14 holds an estimated 15,000 prisoners. About 30 miles long and 15 miles wide, it has farms, mines, and factories threaded through steep mountain valleys. Although Shin is the only one born in a labor camp to escape to tell his story, there are at least 26 other eyewitnesses from the labor camps now in the free world. They include at least 15 North Koreans who were imprisoned in Camp 15's Edification District, won their release, and later turned up in South Korea. Former guards from other camps have also found their way to South Korea. Kim Young, a former North Korean lieutenant colonel from a privileged background in Pyongyang, spent 6 years in two camps before escaping in a coal train. A distillation of their testimony by the Korean Bar Association in Seoul paints a detailed picture of daily life in the camps. A few prisoners are publicly executed every year. Others are beaten to death or secretly murdered by guards, who have almost complete license to abuse and rape prisoners. Most prisoners tend crops, mine coal, sew military uniforms, or make cement while subsisting on a near-starvation diet of corn, cabbage, and salt. They lose their teeth, their gums turn black, their bones weaken, and as they enter their 40s, they hunch over at the waist. Issued a set of clothes once or twice a year, they commonly work and sleep in filthy rags, living without soap, socks, gloves, underclothes, or toilet paper. 12 to 15-hour workdays are mandatory until prisoners die, usually of malnutrition-related illnesses, before they turn 50. Although precise numbers are impossible to obtain, Western governments and human rights groups estimate that hundreds of thousands of people have perished in these camps. Most North Koreans are sent to the camps without any judicial process, and many die there without learning the charges against them. They are taken from their homes, usually at night, by the Buibu, the National Security Agency. Guilt by association is legal in North Korea. A wrongdoer is often imprisoned with his parents and children. Kim Il-sung laid down the law in 1972. Enemies of class, whoever they are, their seed must be eliminated through 3 generations. My first encounter with Shin was at lunch in the winter of 2008. We met in a Korean restaurant in downtown Seoul. Talkative and hungry, he wolfed down several helpings of rice and beef. As he ate, he told my translator and me what it was like to watch as his mother was hanged. He blamed her for his torture in the camp, and he went out of his way to say that he was still furious with her. He said he had not been a good son, but would not explain why. During his years in the camp, he said he had never once heard the word love, certainly not from his mother, a woman he continued to despise even in death. He had heard about the concept of forgiveness in a South Korean church, but it confused him. To ask for forgiveness in Camp 14, he said, was to beg not to be punished. He had written a memoir about the camp, but it had received little attention in South Korea. He was jobless, broke, behind on his rent, and uncertain what to do next. The rules of Camp 14 had prevented him, on pain of execution, from having intimate contact with a woman. He now wanted to find a proper girlfriend, but said he didn't know how to begin looking for one. After lunch, he took me to the small, sad apartment in Seoul that he could not afford. Although he would not look me in the eye, he showed me his chopped-off finger and his scarred back. He allowed me to take his photograph. For all the hardship he had endured, he had a baby face. He was 26 years old, 3 years out of Camp 14. I was 56 years old at that memorable lunch. As a correspondent for the Washington Post in Northeast Asia, I had been searching for more than a year for a story that could explain how North Korea used repression to keep from falling apart. Political implosion had become my specialty. For the Post and for the New York Times, I had spent nearly 3 decades covering failed states in Africa, the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, the breakup of Yugoslavia, and the slow-motion rot in Burma under the generals. From the outside looking in, North Korea seemed ripe, indeed overripe, for the kind of collapse I had witnessed elsewhere. In a part of the world where nearly everyone else was getting rich, its people were increasingly isolated, poor, and hungry. Still, the Kim family dynasty kept the lid on. Totalitarian repression preserved their basket case state. My problem in showing how the government did it was lack of access. Elsewhere in the world, repressive states were not always successful in sealing their borders. I had been able to work openly in Mengistu's Ethiopia, Mobutu's Congo, and Milosevic's Serbia, and had slipped in as a tourist to write about Burma. North Korea was much more careful. Foreign reporters, especially Americans, were rarely allowed inside. I visited North Korea only once and saw what my minders wanted me to see and learned little. If journalists entered illegally, they risked months or years of imprisonment as spies. To win release, they sometimes needed the help of a former American president. Given these restrictions, most reporting about North Korea was distant and hollow. Written from Seoul or Tokyo or Beijing, stories began with an account of Pyongyang's latest provocation, such as sinking a ship or shooting a tourist. Then the dreary conventions of journalism kicked in. American and South Korean officials expressed outrage. Chinese officials called for restraint. Think tank experts opined about what it might mean. I wrote more than my share of these pieces. Shin, though, shattered these conventions. His life unlocked the door, allowing outsiders to see how the Kim family sustained itself with child slavery and murder. A few days after we met, Shin's appealing picture and appalling story ran prominently on the front page of the Washington Post. "Wow," wrote Donald G. Graham, chairman of the Washington Post Company, in a one-word email I received the morning after the story appeared. A German filmmaker, who happened to be visiting Washington's Holocaust Memorial Museum on the day the story was published, decided to make a documentary about Shin's life. The Washington Post ran an editorial saying that the brutality Shin endured was horrifying, but just as horrifying was the world's indifference to the existence of North Korea's labor camps. The editorial concluded, "High school students in America debate why President Franklin D. Roosevelt didn't bomb the rail lines to Hitler's camps." Their children may ask, a generation from now, why the West stared at far clearer satellite images of Kim Jong-il's camps and did nothing. Shin's story seemed to get under the skin of ordinary readers. They wrote letters and sent emails offering money, housing, and prayers. A married couple in Columbus, Ohio, saw the article, located Shin, and paid him to travel to the United States. Lowell and Linda Dai told Shin they wanted to be the parents he never had. A young Korean-American woman in Seattle, Harim Lee, read the story and prayed that she would meet Shin. She later sought him out in Southern California, and they fell in love. My article had only skimmed the surface of Shin's life. It struck me that a deeper account would unveil the secret machinery that enforces totalitarian rule in North Korea. It would also show, through the details of Shin's improbable flight, how some of that oppressive machinery is breaking down, allowing an unworldly young escapee to wander undetected across a police state and cross into China. As important, no one who read a book about a boy bred by North Korea to be worked to death could ever ignore the existence of the camps. I asked Shin if he was interested. It took him 9 months to make up his mind. During those months, human rights activists in South Korea, Japan, and the United States urged him to cooperate, telling him that a book in English would raise world awareness, increase international pressure on North Korea, and perhaps put some much-needed money in his pocket. After Shin said yes, he made himself available for 7 rounds of interviews, first in Seoul, then in Torrance, California, and finally in Seattle, Washington. Shin and I agreed to a 50-50 split of whatever it might earn. Our agreement, though, gave me control over the contents. Shin began keeping a diary in early 2006, about a year after his escape from North Korea. In Seoul, after he was hospitalized for depression, he continued writing in it. The diary became the basis for his Korean language memoir, Escape to the Outside World, which was published in Seoul in 2007 by the Database Center for North Korean Human Rights. The memoir was a starting point for our interviews. It was also the source for many of the direct quotations that are attributed in this book to Shin, his family, friends, and prison keepers during the time he was in North Korea and China. But every thought and action attributed to Shin in these pages is based on multiple interviews with him, during which he expanded upon and in many crucial instances corrected his Korean memoir. Even as he cooperated, Shin seemed to dread talking to me. I often felt like a dentist, drilling without anesthetics. The drilling went on intermittently for more than 2 years. Some of our sessions were cathartic for him. Many others made him depressed. He struggled to trust me. As he readily admits, he struggles to trust anyone. It is an inescapable part of how he was raised. Guards taught him to sell out his parents and friends, and he assumes everyone he meets will sell him out in turn. In writing this book, I have sometimes struggled to trust him. He misled me in our first interview about his role in the death of his mother, and he continued to do so in more than a dozen interviews. When he changed his story, I became worried about what else he might have made up. Fact-checking is not possible in North Korea. Outsiders have not visited its political prison camps. Accounts of what goes on inside them cannot be independently verified. Although satellite images have greatly added to outside understanding of the camps, defectors remain the primary sources of information, and their motives and credibility are not spotless. In South Korea and elsewhere, they are often desperate to make a living, willing to confirm the preconceptions of human rights activists, anti-communist missionaries, and right-wing ideologues. Some camp survivors refuse to talk unless they are paid cash up front. Others repeated juicy anecdotes they had heard but not personally witnessed. While Shin remained wary of me, he responded to every question about his past that I could think of. His life can seem incredible, but it echoes the experiences of other former prisoners in the camps, as well as the accounts of former camp guards. "Everything Shin has said is consistent with what I have heard about the camps," said David Hawk, a human rights specialist who has interviewed Shin and more than 24 other former labor camp prisoners for The Hidden Gulag, Exposing North Korea's Prison Camps, a report that links survivors' accounts with annotated satellite images. It was first published in 2003 by the U.S. Committee for Human Rights in North Korea and has been updated as more testimony and higher-resolution satellite images became available. Hawk told me that because Shin was born and raised in a camp, he knows things that other camp survivors do not. Shin's story has also been vetted by the authors of the Korean Bar Association's White Paper on Human Rights in North Korea, 2008. They conducted extensive interviews with Shin, as well as with other known camp survivors willing to talk. As Hawk has written, the only way for North Korea to refute, contradict, or invalidate the testimony of Shin and other camp survivors would be to permit outside experts to visit the camps. Otherwise, Hawk declares, their testimony stands. If North Korea does collapse, Shin may be correct in predicting that its leaders, fearing war crimes trials, will demolish the camps before investigators can get to them. As Kim Jong-il explained, "We must envelop our environment in a dense fog to prevent our enemies from learning anything about us." To try to piece together what I could not see, I spent the better part of 3 years reporting about North Korea's military, leadership, economy, food shortages, and human rights abuses. I interviewed scores of North Korean defectors, including 3 former inmates of Camp 15 and a former camp guard and driver who worked at 4 labor camps. I spoke to South Korean scholars and technocrats who travel regularly inside North Korea, and I reviewed the growing body of scholarly research on and personal memoirs about the camps. In the United States, I conducted extended interviews with Korean Americans who have become Shin's closest friends. In assessing Shin's story, one should keep in mind that many others in the camps have endured similar or worse hardships, according to An Myung-chul, a former camp guard and driver. Shin had a relatively comfortable life by the standards of other children in the camps, Ann said. By exploding nuclear bombs, attacking South Korea, and cultivating a reputation for hair-trigger belligerence, the government of North Korea has stirred up a semi-permanent security emergency on the Korean Peninsula. When North Korea deigns to enter into international diplomacy, it has always succeeded in shoving human rights off any negotiating table. Crisis management, usually focused on nuclear weapons and missiles, has dominated American dealings with the North. The labor camps have been an afterthought. Talking to them about the camps is something that has not been possible. David Straub, who worked at the State Department during the Clinton and Bush years as a senior official responsible for North Korean policy, told me, "They go nuts when you talk about it. The camps have barely pricked the world's collective conscience. In the United States, newspaper stories notwithstanding, ignorance of their existence remains widespread. For several years in Washington, a handful of North Korean defectors and camp survivors gathered each spring on the Mall for speeches and marches. The Washington Press Corps paid little attention. Part of the reason was language. Most of the defectors spoke only Korean. As important, in a media culture that feeds on celebrity, no movie star, no pop idol, no Nobel Prize winner stepped forward to demand that outsiders invest emotionally in a distant issue that lacks good video." Suzanne Schulte, a longtime activist who brought camp survivors to Washington, told me that Tibetans have the Dalai Lama and Richard Gere. Burmese have Aung San Suu Kyi. Darfurians have Mia Farrow and George Clooney. North Koreans have no one like that. Shin told me he does not deserve to speak for the tens of thousands still in the camps. He is ashamed of what he did to survive and escape. He has resisted learning English, in part because he does not want to have to tell his story again and again in a language that might make him important. But he desperately wants the world to understand what North Korea has tried so diligently to hide. His burden is a heavy one. No one else born and raised in the camps has escaped to explain what went on inside, what still goes on inside. Chapter 1. The Boy Who Ate His Mother's Lunch. Shin and his mother lived in the best prisoner quarters Camp 14 had to offer, a model village next to an orchard and just across from the field where his mother was later hanged. Each of the 40 one-story buildings in the village housed four families. Shin and his mother had their own room where they slept side by side on a concrete floor. The four families shared a common kitchen, which had a single bare light bulb. Electricity ran 2 hours a day, from 4 to 5 in the morning and 10 to 11 at night. Windows were made of gray vinyl, too opaque to see through. Rooms were heated, in the Korean way, by a coal fire in the kitchen with flues running under the bedroom floor. The camp had its own coal mines, and coal for heating was readily available. There were no beds, chairs, or tables. There was no running water, no bath or shower. Prisoners who wanted to bathe sometimes sneaked down to the river in the summer. About 30 families shared a well for drinking water. They also shared a privy, which was divided in half for men and women. Defecating and urinating there were mandatory, as human waste was used as fertilizer on the camp farm. If Shin's mother met her daily work quota, she could bring home food for that night and the following day. At 4 in the morning, she would prepare breakfast and lunch for her son and for herself. Every meal was the same: corn porridge, pickled cabbage, and cabbage soup. Shin ate this meal nearly every day for 23 years, unless he was denied food as punishment. When he was too young for school, his mother often left him alone in the house in the morning and came back from the fields at midday for lunch. Shin was always hungry, and he would eat his lunch as soon as his mother left for work in the morning. He also ate her lunch. When she came back at midday and found nothing to eat, she would become furious and beat her son with a hoe, a shovel, anything close at hand. Some of the beatings were as violent as those he later received from guards. Still, Shin took as much food as he could from his mother as often as he could. It did not occur to him that if he ate her lunch, she would go hungry. Many years later, after she was dead, and he was living in the United States, he would tell me that he loved his mother, but that was in retrospect. That was after he learned that a civilized child should love his mother. When he was in the camp, depending on her for all his meals, stealing her food, enduring her beatings, he saw her as competition for survival. Her name was Jang Hee-kyung. Shin remembers her as short and slightly plump, with powerful arms. She wore her hair cut short, like all women in the camp, and was required to cover her head with a white cloth folded into a triangle that tied around the back of her neck. Shin discovered her birth date, October 1, 1950, from a document he saw during his interrogation in the underground prison. She never talked to him about her past, her family, or why she was in the camp, and he never asked. His existence as her son had been arranged by guards. They chose her and the man who became Shin's father as prizes for each other in a reward marriage. Single men and women slept in dormitories segregated by sex. The eighth rule of Camp 14, as Shin was required to memorize it, said, "Should sexual physical contact occur without prior approval, the perpetrators will be shot immediately." Rules were the same in other North Korean labor camps. If unauthorized sex resulted in a pregnancy or a birth, the woman and her baby were usually killed, according to my interviews with a former camp guard and several former prisoners. They said that women who had sex with guards in an attempt to get more food or easier work knew that the risks were high. If they became pregnant, they disappeared. A reward marriage was the only safe way around the no-sex rule. Marriage was dangled in front of prisoners as the ultimate bonus for hard work and reliable snitching. Men became eligible at 25, women at 23. Guards announced marriages 3 or 4 times a year, usually on propitious dates such as New Year's or Kim Jong-il's birthday. Neither bride nor groom had much say in deciding whom they would marry. If one partner found his or her chosen mate to be unacceptably old, cruel, or ugly, guards would sometimes cancel a marriage. If they did, neither the man nor the woman would be allowed to marry again. Shin's father, Shin Gyeong-sub, told Shin that guards gave him Jang as payment for his skill in operating a metal lathe in the camp's machine shop. Shin's mother never told Shin why she had been given the honor of marriage. But for her, as for many brides in the camp, marriage was a kind of promotion. It came with a slightly better job and better housing in the model village, where there was a school and health clinic. Shortly after her marriage, she was transferred there from a crowded dormitory for women in the camp's garment factory. Jang was also given a coveted job on a nearby farm, where there were opportunities to steal corn, rice, and green vegetables. After their marriage, the couple was allowed to sleep together for 5 consecutive nights. From then on, Shin's father, who continued to live in a dormitory at his work site, was permitted to visit Jang a few times a year. Their liaison produced 2 sons. The eldest, Hee-gyun, was born in 1974. Shin was born 8 years later. The brothers barely knew each other. When Shin was born, his older brother was away in primary school for 10 hours a day. By the time Shin was 4, his brother had moved out of the house at the mandatory age of 12 and into a dormitory. As for his father, Shin remembers that he sometimes showed up at night and left early in the morning. He paid little attention to the boy, and Shin grew up indifferent to his presence. In the years after he escaped the camp, Shin learned that many people associate warmth, security, and affection with the words mother, father, and brother. That was not his experience. Guards taught him and other children in the camp that they were prisoners because of the sins of their parents. The children were told that while they should always be ashamed of their traitorous blood, they could go a long way toward washing away their inherent sinfulness by working hard, obeying the guards, and informing on their parents. The 10th rule of Camp 14 said that a prisoner must truly consider each guard as his teacher. That made sense to Shin. As a child and as a teen, his parents were exhausted, distant, and uncommunicative. Shin was a scrawny, incurious, and for the most part friendless child, whose one source of certainty was the guard's lectures about redemption through snitching. His understanding of right and wrong, though, was often muddied by encounters he witnessed between his mother and camp guards. When he was 10, Shin left his house one evening and went looking for his mother. He was hungry, and it was time for her to prepare dinner. He walked to a nearby rice field where his mother worked and asked a woman if she had seen her. "She's cleaning the Boeji Dewan's room," the woman told him, referring to the office of the guard in charge of the rice farm. Shin walked to the guard's office and found the front door locked. He peeked through a window on the side of the building. His mother was on her knees cleaning the floor. As Shin watched, the Boeji Dewan came into view. He approached Shin's mother from behind and began to grope her. She offered no resistance. Both of them removed their clothes. Shin watched them have sex. He never asked his mother about what he saw and never mentioned it to his father. That same year, students in Shin's class at primary school were required to volunteer to help their parents at work. He joined his mother one morning to plant rice seedlings. She seemed unwell and fell behind in her planting. Shortly before the lunch break, her slack pace caught the eye of a guard. "You bitch," he shouted at her. Bitch was the standard form of address when camp guards spoke to female prisoners. Guards usually called Shin and other male prisoners son of a bitch. "How are you able to stuff your face when you can't even plant rice?" the guard asked. She apologized, but the guard grew increasingly angry. "This bitch won't do," he shouted. As Shin stood beside his mother, the guard invented a punishment for her. "Go kneel on that ridge there and raise your arms. Stay in that position until I come back from lunch." Shin's mother knelt on the ridge in the sun for an hour and a half, arms reaching for the sky. The boy stood nearby and watched. He did not know what to say to her. He said nothing. When the guard returned, he ordered Shin's mother back to work. Weak and hungry, she passed out in the middle of the afternoon. Shin ran to the guard, begging him for help. Other workers dragged his mother to a shaded rest area, where she regained consciousness. That evening, Shin went with his mother to an ideological struggle meeting, a compulsory gathering for self-criticism. Shin's mother again fell to her knees at the meeting, as 40 of her fellow farm workers followed the Boiji Dowan's lead and berated her for failing to fill her work quota. On summer nights, Shin and some of the other small boys in his village would sneak into the orchard just north of the cluster of concrete dwellings where they lived. They picked unripe pears and cucumbers and ate them as quickly as they could. When they were caught, guards would beat them with batons and ban them from lunch at school for several days. Guards, though, did not care if Shin and his friends ate rats, frogs, snakes, and insects. They were intermittently abundant in the sprawling camp, which used few pesticides, relied on human waste as fertilizer, and supplied no water for cleaning privies or taking baths. Eating rats not only filled his stomach, it was essential to survival. Their flesh could help prevent pellagra, a sometimes fatal disease that was rampant in the camp, especially in the winter. Prisoners with pellagra, the result of a lack of protein and niacin in their diets, suffered weakness, skin lesions, diarrhea, and dementia. It was a frequent cause of death. Catching and roasting rats became a passion for Shin. He caught them in his house, in the fields, and in the privy. He would meet his friends in the evening at his primary school, where there was a coal grill to roast them. Shin peeled away their skin, scraped away their innards, salted what was left, and chewed the rest, flesh, bones, and tiny feet. He also learned to use the stems of foxtail grass to spear grasshoppers, long-headed locusts, and dragonflies, which he roasted over a fire in late summer and autumn. In the mountain forests, where groups of students were often sent to gather wood, Shin ate wild grapes, gooseberries, and Korean raspberries by the fistful. During winter, spring, and early summer, there was much less to eat. Hunger drove him and his boyhood friends to try strategies that older prisoners in the camp claimed could ease the discomfort of an empty stomach. They ate meals without water or soup, under the theory that liquid accelerated digestion and quickened the return of hunger pangs. They also tried to refrain from defecating, believing that this would make them feel full and less obsessed with food. An alternative hunger-fighting technique was to imitate cows, regurgitating a recent meal and eating it again. Shin tried this a few times, but it didn't help ease his hunger. Summertime, when children were sent to the fields to help plant and weed, was peak season for rats and field mice. Shin remembers eating them every day. His happiest, most contented childhood moments were when his belly was full. The eating problem, as it's often called in North Korea, is not confined to labor camps. It has stunted the bodies of millions across the country. Teenage boys fleeing the North in the past decade are on average 5 inches shorter and weigh 25 pounds less than boys growing up in South Korea. Mental retardation caused by early childhood malnutrition disqualifies about a quarter of potential military conscripts in North Korea, according to the National Intelligence Council, a research institution that is part of the U.S. intelligence community. Its report said hunger-caused intellectual disabilities among the young were likely to cripple economic growth even if the country opened to the outside world or united with the South. Since the 1990s, North Korea has been unable to grow, buy, or deliver enough food to feed its population. Famine in the mid-1990s killed perhaps 1 million North Koreans. A similar death rate in the United States would claim about 12 million lives. The North's food disaster eased in the late 1990s as the government agreed to receive international food aid. The United States became North Korea's largest aid donor while remaining its most demonized enemy. Every year, North Korea needs to produce more than 5 million tons of rice and cereal grain to feed its 23 million people. Nearly every year it falls short, usually by about 1 million tons. With long winters and high mountains, the country lacks arable land, denies incentives to farmers, and cannot afford fuel or modern farm equipment. It squeaked by for years without a food catastrophe thanks to subsidies from Moscow. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the subsidies ended, and North Korea's centrally planned economy stopped functioning. There was no free fuel for its aging factories, no guaranteed markets for its often shoddy goods, and no access to cheap, Soviet-made chemical fertilizers on which state farms had become dependent. For several years, South Korea helped fill the gap, giving Pyongyang 500,000 tons of fertilizer annually as part of its sunshine policy to ease North-South tensions. When new leadership in Seoul cut off the free fertilizer in 2008, North Korea tried to do nationally what has been doing for decades in its labor camps. The masses were told to make toibi, a fertilizer in which ash is mixed with human excrement. In recent winters, frozen human waste has been chipped out of public toilets in cities and towns across the country. Factories, public enterprises, and neighborhoods have been ordered to produce 2 tons of toibi, according to Good Friends, a Buddhist charity with informants in North Korea. In the spring, it was dried in the open air before being transported to state farms. But organic fertilizers have not come close to replacing the chemicals that state farms depended on for decades. Sealed away behind an electrified fence during the 1990s, Shin was unaware that millions of his countrymen were desperately hungry. Neither he nor his parents, as far as Shin knew, heard that the government was struggling to feed the army or that people were dying of starvation in their apartments in North Korean cities, including the capital. They did not know that tens of thousands of North Koreans had abandoned their homes and were walking into China in search of food. Nor were they beneficiaries of the billions of dollars worth of food aid that poured into North Korea. During those chaotic years, as the basic functioning of Kim Jong-il's government stalled, think tank experts in the West were writing books with doomsday titles such as The End of North Korea. The end was nowhere in sight inside Camp 14, which was self-sufficient except for occasional trainloads of salt. Prisoners grew their own corn and cabbage. As slave workers, they produced low-cost vegetables and fruit, farmed fish and pork, and made uniforms, cement, pottery, and glassware for the crumbling economy outside the fence. Shin and his mother were miserable and hungry during the famine, but no more than they were accustomed to. The boy carried on as before, hunting rats, filching his mother's food, and always enduring her beatings. Chapter 2. School Days. The teacher sprang a surprise search. He rifled through Shin's pockets and those of the 40 other six-year-olds in his class. When it was over, the teacher held 5 kernels of corn. They all belonged to a girl who was short, slight, and, as Shin remembers, exceptionally pretty. He doesn't recall the girl's name, but everything else about that school day in June 1989 stands out in his memory. The teacher was in a bad mood as he began searching pockets. When he found corn, he erupted. "You bitch! You stole corn! You want your hands cut off?" He ordered the girl to the front of the class and told her to kneel. Swinging his long wooden pointer, he struck her on the head again and again. As Shin and his classmates watched in silence, lumps puffed up on her skull. Blood leaked from her nose. She toppled over onto the concrete floor. Shin and several other classmates picked her up and carried her home to a pig farm not far from the school. Later that night, she died. Subsection 3 of Camp 14's third rule said, "Anyone who steals or conceals any foodstuffs will be shot immediately. Shin had learned that teachers usually did not take this rule seriously. If they found food in a student's pocket, they would sometimes deliver a couple of desultory whacks with a stick. More often, they would do nothing. It was common for Shin and other students to take a chance. The pretty little girl was just unlucky, as Shin saw it. He had been trained by guards and teachers to believe that every time he was beaten, he deserved it, because of the treasonous blood he had inherited from his parents. The girl was no different. Shin thought her punishment was just and fair, and he never became angry with his teacher for killing her. He believed his classmates felt the same way. At school the next day, no mention was made of the beating. Nothing changed in the classroom. As far as Shin was aware, the teacher was not disciplined for his actions. Shin spent all 5 years of primary school in class with this same teacher, who was in his early 30s, wore a uniform, and carried a pistol and a holster on his hip. In breaks between classes, he allowed students to play rock, paper, scissors. On Saturdays, he would sometimes grant children an hour or two to pick lice out of each other's hair. Shin never learned his name. In grade school, Shin was taught to stand up straight, bow to his teachers, and never look them in the eye. At the start of school, he was given a black uniform, pants, shirt, an undershirt, and a pair of shoes. They were replaced every 2 years, although they began to fall apart within a month or two. Soap was sometimes distributed to students as a special reward for hard work. Shin did not distinguish himself with diligence and rarely touched soap. His pants were cardboard stiff from dirt and sweat. If he scraped his skin with a fingernail, grime flaked off. When it was too cold to bathe in the river or stand outside in the rain, Shin and his mother and his classmates smelled like farm animals. Nearly everyone's kneecaps turned black in winter from the dirt. Shin's mother sewed underwear and socks for him out of rags. After her death, he wore no underwear and struggled to find rags to wear inside his shoes. School, a cluster of buildings readily viewed on satellite photographs, was about a 7-minute walk from Shin's house. Windows there were made of glass, not vinyl. That was the only frill. Like his mother's house, Shin's classroom was made of concrete. The teacher stood at a podium in front of a single blackboard. Boys and girls sat separately on either side of a middle aisle. Portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, the centerpieces of every classroom in North Korea, were nowhere to be found. Instead, the school taught rudimentary literacy and numeracy, drilled children in camp rules, and constantly reminded them of their iniquitous blood. Primary school students attended class 6 days a week. Secondary students attended 7, with 1 day off a month. "You have to wash away the sins of your mothers and fathers, so work hard," the headmaster told them at assemblies. The school day began promptly at 8 with a session called Changhwa. It means total harmony, but it was an occasion for the teacher to criticize students for what they had done wrong the previous day. Attendance was checked twice daily. No matter how sick a student might be, absences were not allowed. Shin occasionally helped his classmates carry an ailing student to school, but he was rarely sick, other than with colds. He was inoculated just once for smallpox. Shin learned how to read and write the Korean alphabet, doing exercises on coarse paper made in the camp from corn husks. Each term, he was given one notebook with 25 pages. For a pencil, he often used a sharpened shaft of charred wood. He did not know of the existence of erasers. There were no reading exercises, as the teacher had the only book. For writing exercises, students were instructed to explain how they had failed to work hard and follow rules. Shin learned to add and subtract, but not to multiply and divide. To this day, when he needs to multiply, he adds a column of numbers. Physical education meant running around outside and playing on iron bars in the schoolyard. Sometimes, students would go down to the river and gather snails for their teacher. There were no ball games. Shin saw a soccer ball for the first time when he was 23, after fleeing to China. The school's long-term goals for students were implicit in what teachers never bothered to teach. They told Shin that North Korea was an independent state and noted the existence of cars and trains. This wasn't much of a revelation, since Shin had seen guards drive cars and there was a train station in the southwest corner of the camp. But teachers said nothing about North Korea's geography, its neighbors, its history, or its leaders. Shin had only a vague notion of who the great leader and the dear leader were. Questions were not allowed in school. They angered teachers and triggered beatings. Teachers talked, students listened. By repetition in class, Shin mastered the alphabet and basic grammar. He learned how to pronounce words, but frequently had no idea what they meant. His teacher made him afraid, on an instinctive level, of trying to seek out new information. Shin never came in contact with a classmate who had been born outside the camp. As far as he could tell, the school was reserved for children like him, the camp-bred spawn of reward marriages. He was told that children born elsewhere and brought into the camp with their parents were denied schooling and confined to the camp's most remote sections, Valleys 4 and 5. His teachers, as a result, could shape the minds and values of students without contradiction from children who might know something about what existed beyond the fence. There was no secret about what was in store for Shin and his classmates. Primary and secondary school trained them for hard labor. In the winter, children cleared snow, chopped down trees, and shoveled coal for heating the school. The entire student body, about 1,000 students, was mobilized to clean privies in the Bowie-Wan village where guards lived, some of them with wives and children. Shin and his classmates went from house to house, chipping out frozen feces with hose and dumping the waste with bare hands, there were no gloves for camp prisoners, on A-frame racks. They dragged the excrement to surrounding fields or carried it on their backs. On warmer, happier days after school ended in the afternoon, Shin's class would sometimes march into the hills and mountains behind the school to collect food and herbs for their guards. Although it was against the rules, they often stuffed bracken, osmunda, and other ferns inside their uniforms and brought them home to their mothers to make side dishes. They picked agaric mushrooms in April and pine mushrooms in October. On these long afternoon walks, children were allowed to talk with each other. Strict segregation between sexes was relaxed, as boys and girls worked, giggled, and played alongside one another. Shin began first grade with two other children from his village, Hong Sung Jo, a boy, and Moon Sung Sim, a girl. They walked to school together for 5 years and sat in the same classroom. In secondary school, they spent another 5 years in one another's company. Shin viewed Hong Sung Jo as his closest companion. They played jacks between classes at school. Their mothers worked at the same farm. Neither boy, though, ever invited the other to his house to play. Trust among friends was poisoned by constant competition for food and pressure to snitch. Trying to win extra food rations, children told teachers and guards what their neighbors were eating, wearing, and saying. Collective punishment at school also turned classmates against each other. Shin's class was often given a daily quota of trees to plant or acorns to gather. If they failed to meet expectations, everyone in his class was penalized. Teachers ordered Shin's class to give up its lunch ration for a day or sometimes a week to another class that had filled its quota. In work details, Shin was usually slow, often last. As Shin and his classmates grew older, their work details, called rallies of endeavor, grew longer and more difficult. During weeding combat, which occurred between June and August, primary school students worked from 4 in the morning until dusk, pulling weeds in corn, bean, and sorghum fields. When Shin and his classmates entered secondary school, they were barely literate. But by then, classroom instruction had come to an end. Teachers became foremen. Secondary school was a staging ground for work details in mines, fields, and forests. At the end of the day, it was a gathering place for long sessions of self-criticism. Shin entered his first coal mine at the age of 10. He and five of his classmates, three boys and three girls, including his neighbor, Moon Sung Sim, walked down a steep shaft to the face of the mine. Their job was to load coal into 2-ton ore cars and push them uphill on a narrow rail track to a staging area. To meet their daily quota, they had to get 4 cars up the hill. The first 2 took all morning. After a lunch of milled corn and salted cabbage, the exhausted children, their faces and clothes covered in coal dust, headed back to the coal face, carrying candles in the ink-black mine. One day, pushing the 3rd car, Moon Sung Sim lost her balance and one of her feet slipped beneath a steel wheel. Shin, who was standing next to her, heard a scream. He tried to help the writhing, sweating girl remove her shoe. Her big toe was crushed and oozing blood. Another student tied a shoelace around her ankle as a kind of tourniquet. Shin and two other boys lifted Moon into an empty coal car and pushed it to the top of the mine. Then they carried her to the camp hospital, where her mangled toe was amputated without anesthetics and treated with salt water. In addition to harder physical work, secondary school students spent more time finding fault with themselves and one another. They wrote in their corn husk notebooks, preparing for the self-censure sessions that took place after the evening meal. About 10 students a night had to admit to something. Shin tried to meet with his classmates before these sessions to sort out who would confess to what. They invented sins that would satisfy teachers without provoking draconian punishment. Shin remembers confessing to eating corn he found on the ground and to taking a catnap when no one was looking. If students volunteered enough transgressions, punishments were usually a smack on the head and a warning to work harder. Wedged closely together, 25 boys slept on the concrete floor in the secondary school dormitory. The strongest boys slept near, but not too near, a coal-heated flue that ran under the floor. Weaker boys, including Shin, slept farther away and often shivered through the night. Some had no choice but to try to sleep on top of the flue, where they risked severe burns when the heating system flared up. Shin remembers a stoutly built, prideful 12-year-old named Ryu Hak Chol. He slept wherever he chose, and he was also the only boy who dared sass a teacher. Ryu ditched his work assignment one day, and his disappearance was quickly reported. His teacher sent Shin's class to find the missing boy. "Why'd you stop working and run away?" the teacher asked when Ryu had been found and marched back to school. To Shin's astonishment, Ryu did not apologize. "I got hungry, so I went to eat," he said flatly. The teacher, too, was astonished. "Is this son of a bitch talking back?" the teacher asked. He ordered students to tie Ryu to a tree. They took off his shirt and bound him with wire. "Beat him until he comes to his senses," the teacher said. Without a second thought, Shin joined his classmates in thrashing Ryu. Chapter 3. The Upper Crust. Shin was 9 years old when the North Korean caste system knocked him on the head. He and about 30 of his classmates were walking in early spring toward the train station where their teacher had sent them to pick up coal that had spilled from railroad cars during loading. The station is near the southwestern corner of Camp 14, and to get there from school, students had to pass below the Bowie-Wan compound, which sits on a bluff above the Taedong River. Children of guards live in the compound and attend school there. From up above, the guards' children shouted at Shin and his classmates as they walked by. "Reactionary sons of bitches are coming!" Rocks the size of fists rained down on the prison children. With the river below and the bluff above, they had no place to hide. A rock hit Shin in the face, just below his left eye, opening up a deep cut. Shin and his classmates shrieked and cowered on the dirt road, trying to protect their heads with their arms and hands. A second rock struck Shin in the head, knocking him to the ground and making him dizzy. When his head cleared, the stoning had stopped. Many of his classmates were moaning and bleeding. Moon, his neighbor and classmate who later lost her big toe in the mine, had been knocked out. The leader of Shin's class, Hong Ju-hyun, who was supposed to be a kind of foreman for the day's work mission, was also out cold. Earlier that morning at school, their teacher had told them to hurry ahead to the train station and start work. He said he would catch up later. When the teacher finally walked down the road and discovered his bloodied student sprawled in the road, he became angry. "What are you doing not getting yourselves to work?" he shouted. Students timidly asked what they should do with classmates who were still unconscious. "Put them on your backs and carry them," the teacher instructed. "All you need to do is work hard." In the years ahead, when Shin spotted Bowie-Wan children anywhere in the camp, he walked in the opposite direction if he could. Bowie-Wan children had every reason to throw stones at the likes of Shin. His blood, as that of the offspring of irredeemable sinners, was tainted in the worst conceivable way. Bowie-Wan children, however, came from families whose lineage had been sanctified by the great leader. To identify and isolate his perceived political enemies, Kim Il-sung created a neo-feudal, blood-based pecking order in 1957. The government classified and, to a considerable extent, segregated the entire North Korean population based on the perceived reliability of an individual's parents and grandparents. North Korea called itself the workers' paradise, but even as it professed allegiance to communist ideals of equality, it invented one of the world's most rigidly stratified caste systems. Three broad classes were created, with 51 subgroups. At the top, members of the core class could obtain jobs in government, the Korean Workers' Party, officer ranks of the military, and the intelligence services. The core class included farm workers, families of soldiers killed during the Korean War, families of troops who had served with Kim Il-sung fighting against Japanese occupation, and government workers. The next level was the wavering or neutral class, which included soldiers, technicians, and teachers. At the bottom was the hostile class, whose members were suspected of opposing the government. They included former property owners, relatives of Koreans who had fled to South Korea, Christians, and those who worked for the Japanese colonial government that controlled the Korean Peninsula before World War II. Their descendants now worked in mines and factories. They are not allowed into universities. Besides dictating career opportunities, the system shaped geographic destiny, with the core class allowed to live in and around Pyongyang. Many members of the hostile class were resettled to distant provinces along the Chinese border. Some members of the wavering class could move up in the system by joining the Korean People's Army, serving with distinction, and with luck and connections securing a lower rung in the ruling party. Also, rapid growth of private markets made some traders from the wavering and hostile classes wealthy, allowing them to buy and bribe their way into better living standards than some of the political elite. For government positions, though, family background decided nearly everything, including who had the right to throw stones at Shin. The only North Koreans considered trustworthy enough to become guards in political prison camps were men like Ahn Myung-chul, the son of a North Korean intelligence officer. He was recruited into the Boibu at 19, after 2 years of military service. As part of the process, the loyalty of his entire extended family was checked. He was also required to sign a document saying he would never disclose the existence of the camps. 60% of the 200 men who were recruited with him as guards were also the sons of intelligence officers. Ahn worked as a guard and driver in four labor camps, not including Camp 14, for 7 years in the late 1980s and early 1990s. He fled to China in 1994 after his father, who supervised regional food distribution, ran afoul of his superiors and committed suicide. After finding his way to South Korea, Ahn found work as a banker in Seoul and married a South Korean woman. They have two children. He also became a human rights activist. After his defection, he learned that his sister and brother were sent to a labor camp, where his brother later died. When we spoke over a Chinese dinner in Seoul in 2009, Ahn wore a dark blue suit, a white shirt, a striped tie, and half-framed glasses. He looked prosperous and spoke in a quiet, careful way. Still, he is a man of intimidating size, with large hands and linebacker shoulders. When he was training to be a guard, he studied the Korean martial art of Taekwondo, learned riot suppression techniques, and was instructed not to worry if his treatment of prisoners caused injury or death. In the camps, he became accustomed to hitting prisoners who did not meet work quotas. He remembers beating up a hunchback prisoner. It was normal to beat prisoners, he said, explaining that his instructors taught him never to smile and to think of inmates as dogs and pigs. We were taught not to think of them as human beings, he said. The instructors told us not to show pity. They said, if you do, you will become a prisoner. Although pity was forbidden, there were few other guidelines for treatment of prisoners. As a result, Ahn said, guards were free to indulge their appetites and eccentricities, often preying on attractive young women prisoners, who would usually consent to sex for better treatment. Ahn said that if this resulted in babies, women and their babies were killed. He noted that he had personally seen newborns clubbed to death with iron rods. The theory behind the camps was to cleanse onto three generations the families of incorrect thinkers, so it was inconsistent to allow another generation to be born. Guards could win admission to college if they caught an inmate trying to escape, an incentive system that ambitious guards seized upon. They would enable prisoners to make an escape attempt, An said, and shoot them before they reached the fences that surround the camps. Most often, though, An said, prisoners were beaten, sometimes to death, simply because guards were bored or in a sour mood. Although prison guards and their legitimate children belong by blood to the core class, they are fringe functionaries locked away for most of their working lives in the freezing hinterlands. The core of the core lives in Pyongyang, in large apartments or single-family homes in gated neighborhoods. Outsiders do not know with any certainty how many of these elite there are in North Korea, but South Korean and American scholars believe they are a tiny fraction of the country's population, numbering between 1 and 200,000 out of 23 million. Trusted and talented members of the elite are periodically allowed outside the country, where they serve as diplomats and traders for state-owned companies. In the past decade, the United States government and law enforcement agencies around the world have documented that some of these North Koreans are involved in criminal enterprises that funnel hard currency to Pyongyang. They have been linked to counterfeiting $100 bills, cyber terrorism, trafficking drugs ranging from heroin to Viagra, and marketing high-quality brand name but counterfeit cigarettes. In violation of United Nations resolutions, North Koreans have also sold rockets and nuclear weapons technology to countries including Iran and Syria, according to UN officials. One well-traveled member of the North Korean elite told me how he earned his keep while securing the support and affections of Kim Jong-il. His name is Kim Kwon-jin. He grew up in Pyongyang as a member of the Blue Blood elite. He studied British literature at Kim Il-sung University, which is reserved for children of top officials. His professional expertise, before defecting to South Korea in 2003, was managing a state-run global insurance fraud. It collected hundreds of millions of dollars from some of the world's largest insurance companies on falsified claims for industrial accidents and natural disasters inside North Korea, and it funneled most of the money to the dear leader. The festive annual highlight of this scheme took place in the week before Kim Jong-il's birthday on February 16th. Foreign-based executives of the Korean National Insurance Corporation, the state monopoly that orchestrated the fraud, prepared a special birthday gift. From his office in Singapore, Kim Kwon-jin watched in early February 2003 as his colleagues stuffed $20 million in cash into two heavy-duty bags and sent them, via Beijing, to Pyongyang. This was money that had been paid by international insurance companies, and it was not a one-time offering. Kim said that in the 5 years he was based in Pyongyang for the State Insurance Corporation, bags of cash always arrived in time for his leader's birthday. He said they came from Switzerland, France, and Austria, as well as from Singapore. The money, he said, was delivered to Office 39 of the Korean Workers' Party's Central Committee. This infamous office, or bureau, was created by Kim Jong-il in the 1970s to collect hard currency and to give him a power base independent of his father, who was then still running the country. According to Kim and scores of other defectors in published accounts, Office 39 buys luxury goods to secure the loyalty of the North Korean elite. It also funds the purchase of foreign-made components for missiles and other weapons programs. As Kim explained it to me, his country's insurance scam worked like this. Pyongyang-based managers for the state insurance monopoly would write policies that covered costly but common North Korean disasters, such as mining accidents, train crashes, and crop losses resulting from floods. The major point of the reinsurance operation is that they are banking on disaster, he said. Whenever there is a disaster, it becomes a source of hard currency for the government. Kim and other foreign-based operatives of the North Korean insurance company were dispatched around the globe to find insurance brokers who would accept seductively high insurance premiums to compensate North Korea for the cost of these disasters. Reinsurance is a multi-billion dollar industry that spreads the risk assumed by one insurance company to a number of companies around the world. Each year, Kim said, North Korea would do its best to shuffle its offerings among the major reinsurance players. We pass it around, he told me. 1 year it might be Lloyd's of London, the next year it might be Swiss Re. By spreading relatively moderate losses among many big companies, North Korea concealed how bad a risk it was. Its government prepared meticulously documented claims, rushed them through its puppet court, and demanded immediate payment. But it often restricted the ability of reinsurers to dispatch investigators to verify claims. According to a London-based expert on the insurance industry, North Korea also exploited the geographical ignorance and political naivete of some reinsurers and their brokers. Many of them thought they were dealing with a firm from South Korea, the expert said, while others were unaware that North Korea is a closed totalitarian state with sham courts and no international accountability. Over time, reinsurance companies got wise to frequent and costly claims for train crashes and ferry sinkings that were all but impossible to investigate. Lawyers for German insurance giant Allianz Global Investors, Lloyd's of London, and several other reinsurers filed suit in a London court against the Korean National Insurance Corporation. They contested its claim for a 2005 crash of a helicopter into a government-owned warehouse in Pyongyang. In court documents, the companies alleged that the crash was staged, that the North Korean court's decision to uphold the claim had been rigged, and that North Korea routinely used insurance fraud to raise money for the personal use of Kim Jong-il. The reinsurance companies, however, dropped their claims and agreed to a settlement that was a near-complete victory for North Korea. They did so, legal analysts said, because they had foolishly signed contracts in which they agreed to be bound by North Korean law. After the settlement, North Korea's lawyers said it was staggeringly unfair to suggest that the country engaged in insurance fraud. But publicity generated by the case alerted the world's reinsurance industry to avoid North Korea, and fraud wound down. When Kim Kwang-jin helped send the $20 million bags of cash from Singapore to Pyongyang, he said that Kim Jong-il was delighted. "We received a letter of thanks, and it was a great celebration," he said, noting that Kim Jong-il arranged for him and his colleagues to receive gifts that included oranges, apples, DVD players, and blankets. Fruit, home electronics, and blankets. This meager display of dictatorial gratitude is telling. In Pyongyang, living standards for the core class are luxurious only by the standards of a country where a third of the population is chronically hungry. Elites have relatively large apartments and access to rice. They are also granted first dibs on imported luxuries such as fruit and liquor. But for residents of Pyongyang, electricity is intermittent at best. Hot water is rarely available, and travel outside the country is difficult except for diplomats and state-sponsored businessmen. An elite family in Pyongyang does not live nearly as well in terms of material possessions, creature comforts, and entertainment options as the family of an average salaryman in Seoul, Andrei Lankov, a Russian-born political scientist who attended college in Pyongyang and now teaches at Kukmin University in Seoul, told me. Average per capita income in South Korea is 15 times as high as in the North, $1,900 in 2009. Countries with higher per capita incomes than North Korea include Sudan, Congo, and Laos. The exception, of course, is the Kim family dynasty. Satellite images of the family's residences stand out like sable-clad thumbs in the mangy landscape of North Korea. The family maintains at least 8 country houses, according to books by his former chef and a former bodyguard. Nearly all of them have movie theaters, basketball courts, and shooting ranges. Several have indoor swimming pools along with entertainment centers for bowling and roller skating. Satellite pictures show a full-size horse racing track, a private train station, and a water park. A private yacht, which has a 50-meter pool with 2 water slides, was photographed near the family's house in Wonsan, which is located on a peninsula with white sandy beaches and is believed to be a family favorite. The former bodyguard said Kim Jong-il often went there to hunt roe deer, pheasants, and wild geese. All his houses have been furnished with imports from Japan and Europe. The family's beef is raised by bodyguards on a special cattle ranch, and their apples come from an organic orchard where sugar, a rare and costly commodity in the north, is added to the soil to sweeten the fruit. The privileges of blood are uniquely rich in the Kim family. Kim Jong-il inherited his dictatorial control of North Korea from his father in 1994, the first hereditary succession in the communist world. The second such succession occurred in December 2011 after Kim's death at age 69. His youngest son, Kim Jong-un, was promptly hailed as the supreme leader of the party, state, and army. Although it was unclear if he, his older relatives, or the generals would wield real power, propagandists worked overtime, manufacturing a new cult of personality. Kim Jong-un was described in the party daily, Rodong Sinmun, as the spiritual pillar and lighthouse of hope for the military and the people. The state news agency noted that the new leader is a prominent thinker, theoretician, and peerlessly illustrious commander who will be a solid foundation for the prosperity of the country. Other than having the right blood, the son's qualifications were meager. He attended a German language school in Liebefeld, Switzerland, where he played point guard on the basketball team and spent hours making pencil drawings of Chicago Bulls great Michael Jordan. He returned to Pyongyang at 17 to attend Kim Il-sung University. Little is known about what he studied there. Preparations for a second father-to-son transfer of power became apparent in Pyongyang shortly after Kim Jong-il suffered a stroke in 2008. It left the dear leader with a noticeable limp and signaled the emergence of Kim Jong-un from obscurity. In lectures delivered to select audiences in Pyongyang in 2009, Kim Jong-un was described as a genius of the literary arts and a patriot who is working without sleep or rest to promote North Korea as a nuclear superpower. A propaganda song, Footsteps, was circulated at military bases to prepare the cadre for the coming of a dynamic young general. He was indeed young, in his late 20s, born in either 1983 or 1984. At his coming out party in September 2010, the young general's face was officially shown to the world for the first time. He was the spitting image of his late grandfather, Kim Il-sung, who was always more beloved than Kim Jong-il. That uncanny resemblance, as Kim Jong-un moved to consolidate power after the death of his father, seemed orchestrated. His clothes and haircut, Mao suits and a short military trim with no sideburns, were the same as his grandfather's when he seized control of North Korea in 1945. Rumors circulated in South Korea that the resemblance had been enhanced by plastic surgeons in Pyongyang to render the young man as a kind of great leader, too. If the new leader is to secure the same steely grip on the country as his father and grandfather, he certainly needs some measure of public support, along with solid backing from the military. His father, Kim Jong-il, might never have been popular, but he had nearly 20 years to learn how to dominate his elders. He had hand-picked many of the leading generals and was effectively running the country when his father died in 1994. Not yet 30 years old, with less than 3 years to learn the levers, Kim Jong-un has no such advantage. Until he figures it out, he will have to depend on his privileged blood, a budding cult of personality, and the loyalty of relatives, courtiers, and generals who may or may not be content to stand in the shadows. Chapter 4. Mother Tries to Escape. Shin was putting on his shoes in the school dormitory when his teacher came looking for him. It was Saturday morning, April 6, 1996. "Hey, Shin, come out as you are," the teacher said. Puzzled as to why he had been summoned, Shin hurried out of the dormitory and into the schoolyard. There, three uniformed men were waiting for him beside a jeep. They handcuffed him, blindfolded him with a strip of black cloth, and pushed him into the back seat of the jeep. Without saying a word, they drove him away. Shin had no idea where he was being taken or why, but after a half hour of bouncing along in the back seat, he became afraid and began to tremble. When the jeep stopped, the men lifted Shin out and stood him on his feet. He heard the clunk of a heavy metal door opening and closing, then the whine of machinery. Guards nudged him into an elevator, and he felt himself descending. He had entered an underground prison inside the camp. After stepping out of the elevator, he was led down a corridor and into a large, bare, windowless room where guards removed his blindfold. Opening his eyes, he saw a military officer with four stars pinned to his uniform. The officer sat behind a desk. Two other guards in khaki stood nearby. One of them ordered Shin to sit down in a straight-backed chair. "You're Shin In-gun?" the officer with four stars asked. "Yes, that is correct," Shin replied.
"Shin Kyung-sub is the name of your father?"
"Yes."
"Jang Hee-kyung is your mother's name?"
"Yes." Shin Hee-gyun is the name of your brother? Yes. The officer stared at Shin for about 5 minutes. Shin could not figure out where the interrogation was headed. Do you know why you're here? The officer asked at last. I don't know. Shall I tell you then? Shin nodded yes. At dawn today, your mother and your brother were caught trying to escape. That's why you're here. Understand? Were you aware of this fact or not? I didn't know. Shin was so shocked by the news that he found it difficult to speak. He wasn't sure if he was awake or dreaming. The officer became increasingly angry and incredulous. How is it possible for you not to know that your mother and brother tried to run away? He asked. If you want to live, you should spit out the truth. No, I really didn't know, Shin said. And your father didn't mention anything? It's been a while since I was last home, Shin replied. When I visited a month ago, I heard nothing. What kind of grievance does your family have to risk an escape? The officer asked. I honestly don't know anything. This was the story that Shin told when he arrived in South Korea in the late summer of 2006. He told it consistently, he told it often, and he told it well. His debriefings in Seoul began with agents from the government's National Intelligence Service, NIS. Experienced interrogators, they conduct extensive interviews with every North Korean defector and have been trained to screen out the assassins that Kim Jong-il's government periodically dispatched to the South. After the NIS, Shin told his stories to counselors and psychiatrists at a government center for resettlement, then to human rights activists and fellow defectors, and then to the local and international news media. He wrote about it in his 2007 Korean language memoir, and he told it to me when we first met in December 2008. He elaborated on it 9 months later during a week of day-long interviews with me in Seoul. There was, of course, no way to confirm what he was saying. Shin was the only available source of information about his early life. His mother and brother were dead. His father was still in the camp, or perhaps dead too. The North Korean government could hardly set the record straight, since it denies that Camp 14 exists. Still, the story had been vetted and rang true to survivors of other labor camps, to scholars, to human rights advocates, and to the South Korean government. I believed it and put it in the story that appeared in the Washington Post. I wrote that since his mother had not told him about the escape plan, Shin was startled to hear of it. On a cloudless morning in Torrance, California, Shin revisited and revised the story. We had been working on the book on and off for about a year, and for the past week we had been sitting across from each other in my dimly lighted room in a Best Western hotel, slowly sifting through the events of his early life. A day before this session, Shin said he had something new and important to disclose. He insisted that we find a new translator. He also invited Hannah Song, his then boss and de facto guardian, to listen in. Song was the executive director of Liberty in North Korea, the human rights group that had helped bring him to the United States. A 29-year-old Korean-American, she helped Shin manage his money, visas, travel, medical care, and behavior. She jokingly described herself as Shin's mom. Shin took off his sandals and tucked his bare feet underneath him on the hotel sofa. I turned on a tape recorder. The sound of morning traffic filtered into the room from Torrance Boulevard. Shin fidgeted with the buttons on his mobile phone. So what's up? I asked. Shin said he had been lying about his mother's escape. He invented the lie just before arriving in South Korea. There were a lot of things I needed to hide, he said. I was terrified of a backlash, of people asking me, are you even human? It has been a burden to keep this inside, he said. In the beginning, I didn't think much of my lie. It was my intent to lie. Now the people around me make me want to be honest. They make me want to be more moral. In that sense, I feel like I need to tell the truth. I now have friends who are honest. I have begun to understand what honesty is. I feel extreme guilt for everything. I was more faithful to guards than to my family. We were each other's spies. I know by telling the truth, people will look down on me. Outsiders have a wrong understanding of the camp. It is not just the soldiers who beat us. It is the prisoners themselves who are not kind to each other. There is no sense of community. I am one of those mean prisoners. Shin said he did not expect forgiveness for what he was about to disclose. He said he had not forgiven himself. He also seemed to be trying to do something more than expiate guilt. He wanted to explain, in a way that he acknowledged would damage his credibility as a witness, how the camp had warped his character. He said that if outsiders could understand what political prison camps have done and are doing to children born inside the fence, it would redeem his lie and his life. Chapter 5. Mother Tries to Escape, Version 2. This story begins a day earlier, on the afternoon of Friday, April 5th, 1996. As school wound down for the day, Shin's teacher surprised him. He told Shin that he did not have to spend the night in the dormitory. He could go home and eat supper with his mother. The teacher was rewarding Shin for good behavior. After 2 years in the dormitory,
he had begun to figure out a few things.
He was less often a laggard, less often beaten, more often a snitch. Shin did not particularly want to spend the night at his mother's place. Living apart had not improved their relationship. He still didn't trust her to take care of him. She still seemed tense in his presence. The teacher, however, told him to go home, so he went. As unexpected as it had been for him to be sent home, there was a bigger surprise when Shin got there.
His brother, Hee Gyun, had come home too.
He worked at the camp's cement factory, located several miles away in the far southeast of the camp.
Shin barely knew and rarely saw Hee Gyun, who had been out of the house for a decade and was now 21.
All that Shin knew about his brother was that he was not a hard worker. He had rarely been granted permission to leave the factory to see his parents. For him to be in his mother's house, Shin thought, he must have finally done something right. Shin's mother was not delighted when her youngest son showed up unexpectedly for supper. She did not say welcome or that she had missed him. "Oh, you're home," she said. Then she cooked, using her daily ration of 700 grams of cornmeal to make porridge in the one pot she owned. With bowls and spoons, she and her sons ate on the kitchen floor. After he had eaten, Shin went to sleep in the bedroom. Voices from the kitchen woke him up. He peeked through the bedroom door, curious about what his mother and brother were up to. His mother was cooking rice. For Shin, this was a slap in the face. He had been served a watery corn soup, the same tasteless gruel he had eaten every day of his life. Now his brother was getting rice. It is difficult to overstate the importance of rice in North Korean culture. It signifies wealth, evokes the closeness of family, and sanctifies a proper meal. Labor camp prisoners almost never eat rice, and its absence is a daily reminder of the normality they can never have. Outside the camp, too, chronic shortages have removed rice from the daily diets of many North Koreans, especially those in the hostile classes. Teenage defectors from the North, when they arrive in South Korea, have told government counselors of a recurring dream. They are sitting at a table with their families, eating warm rice. Among the elite in Pyongyang, one of the most coveted signifiers of status is an electric rice cooker. As Shin watched his mother cook, he guessed she must have stolen the rice, a few grains at a time, from the farm where she worked and secreted it away in her house. In the bedroom, Shin fumed. He also listened. His brother was doing most of the talking. Shin heard that Hee Gyun had not been given the day off. Without permission, he had walked away from the cement factory, where he had apparently done something wrong. Shin realized his brother was in trouble, and that he would probably be punished when guards caught up with him. His mother and brother were discussing what they should do. Escape. Shin was astonished to hear the word. His brother said it. He was planning to run. His mother was helping him. Her precious hoard of rice was food for flight. Shin did not hear his mother say that she intended to go along, but she was not trying to argue her eldest into staying, even though she knew that if he escaped or died trying, she and others in her family would be tortured and probably killed. Every prisoner knew the first rule of Camp 14, subsection 2. Any witness to an attempted escape who fails to report it will be shot immediately. His mother did not sound alarmed, but Shin was. His heart pounded. He was angry that she would put his life at risk for the sake of his older brother. He was afraid he would be implicated in the escape and shot. He was also jealous that his brother was getting rice. On the floor of his mother's bedroom, as the aggrieved 13-year-old struggled to contain his fear, Shin's camp-bred instincts took over. He had to tell a guard. He got up off the floor, went into the kitchen, and headed out the door. "Where are you going?" his mother asked. "To the toilet," he said. Shin ran back to his school. It was 1 in the morning. He entered the school dormitory. His teacher had gone home to the gated Bowiwan village. Whom could he tell? In the crowded dormitory room where his class slept, Shin found his friend, Hong Sung Jo, and woke him up. As much as Shin trusted anyone, he trusted this boy. Shin told him what his mother and brother were planning and asked for advice. Hong told him to tell the school's night guard. They went together. As they walked to the guard's office in the main school building, Shin thought of a way to profit from his information. The guard was awake and in uniform. He told both boys to come inside his office. "I need to say something to you," Shin told the guard, whom he did not know. "But before I do, I want to get something in return." The guard assured Shin that he would help. "I want a guarantee of more food," Shin said. Shin's second demand was that he be named grade leader at school, a position that would allow him to work less and not be beaten as often. The guard guaranteed Shin that his request would be granted. Accepting the guard's word, Shin explained what his brother and mother were planning and where they were. The guard telephoned his superiors. He told Shin and Hong to go back to the dormitory and get some sleep. He would take care of everything. On the morning after he betrayed his mother and brother, uniformed men did come to the schoolyard for Shin. Just as he wrote in his memoir, just as he told everyone in South Korea, he was handcuffed, blindfolded, pushed into the back seat of a jeep, and driven away in silence to an underground prison inside the camp. But Shin knew why he had been summoned, and the guards in charge of Camp 14, he expected, knew he had tipped them off. Chapter 6. This son of a bitch won't do. "Do you know why you're here?" Shin knew what he had done. He had followed camp rules and stopped an escape. But the officer did not know, or did not care, that Shin had been a dutiful informer. "At dawn today, your mother and your brother were caught trying to escape. That's why you're here, understand? Were you aware of this fact or not? How is it possible for you not to know that your mother and brother tried to run away? If you want to live, you should spit out the truth." Confused and increasingly frightened, Shin found it difficult to speak. He was an informant. He could not understand why he was being interrogated as an accomplice. Shin would eventually figure out that the night guard at the school had claimed all the credit for discovering the escape plan. In reporting to his superiors, he had not mentioned Shin's role. But on that morning in the underground prison, Shin understood nothing. He was a bewildered 13-year-old. The officer with 4 stars kept asking him about the whys, whens, and hows of his family's escape plan. Shin was unable to say anything coherent. Finally, the officer pushed some papers across his desk. "In that case, bastard, read this and affix your thumbprint at the bottom." The document was a family rap sheet. It listed the names, ages, and crimes of Shin's father and of his father's 11 brothers. The eldest brother, Shin Tae Sub, was listed first. Next to his name was a date, 1951, the second year of the Korean War. On the same line, Shin saw his uncle's crimes, disruption of public peace, acts of brutality, and defection to the South. The same offenses were listed beside the name of Shin's second oldest uncle. It took Shin many months to understand what he had been allowed to see. The papers explained why his father's family had been locked up in Camp 14. The unforgivable crime Shin's father had committed was being the brother of 2 young men who had fled south during a fratricidal war that razed much of the Korean peninsula and divided hundreds of thousands of families. Shin's unforgivable crime was being his father's son. Shin's father had never explained any of this. His father later told Shin about the day in 1965 when the family was taken away by security forces.
"Before dawn, they forced their way into a house owned by Shin's grandfather in Mundok County in South Pyongan Province.
It's a fertile farming area located about 35 miles north of Pyongyang. Pack your things," the armed men shouted. They did not explain why the family was being arrested or where they were going. At daybreak, a truck showed up for their belongings. The family traveled for an entire day, a distance of about 45 miles on mountain roads, before arriving at Camp 14. As ordered, Shin put his thumbprint on the document. Guards blindfolded him again, led him out of the interrogation room, and marched him down a corridor. When they pulled away the blindfold, Shin read the number 7 on a cell door. Guards pushed him inside and tossed him a prison uniform. "Hey, son of a bitch, change into this." The uniform fit a large adult. When Shin pulled it over his short, bony frame, he disappeared into what felt like a burlap sack. Shin's cell was a concrete square, barely large enough for him to lie down. It had a toilet in the corner and a sink with running water. The light bulb hanging from the ceiling was on when Shin entered the cell, and it could not be turned off. Without windows, Shin could not distinguish night from day. There were 2 thin blankets on the floor. He was given nothing to eat and could not sleep. He believes it was the next day when guards opened the door, blindfolded him, and led him to a second interrogation room, where 2 new officers were waiting. They ordered Shin to kneel and pressed him to explain why his family wanted to escape. What grudges did his mother harbor? What did he discuss with her? What were his brother's intentions? Shin said he did not have answers to their questions. "You haven't lived but a few years," one of the guards told Shin. "Just confess and go out and live. Would you like to die in here?" I really don't know anything," he replied. He was increasingly frightened, increasingly hungry, and still struggling to understand why the guards did not know he was the one who had tipped them off. The guards sent him back to his cell. On what seemed to be the morning of the third day, one of his interrogators and 3 other guards entered Shin's cell. They shackled his ankles, tied a rope to a hook in the ceiling, and hung him upside down. Then they left and locked the door, all without a word. His feet almost touched the ceiling. His head was suspended about 2 feet above the floor.
Reaching out with his hands, which the guards had left untied,
Shin could not quite touch the floor. He squirmed and swung around, trying to right himself, but could not. His neck cramped and his ankles hurt. Eventually, his legs went numb. His head, flushed with blood, ached more with each hour. Guards did not return until evening. They untied the boy and left, again without a word. Food arrived in his cell, but Shin found it almost impossible to eat. He could not move his fingers. His ankles, owing to the sharp steel edges of the shackles, were gouged and bleeding. On the 4th day, the interrogators wore civilian clothes, not uniforms. After being blindfolded and marched from his cell, Shin met them in a dimly lighted room with a high ceiling. It had the look of a machine shop. A chain dangled from a winch on the ceiling. Hooks on the walls held a hammer, axe, pliers, and clubs of various shapes and sizes. On a wide shop table, Shin saw a large pair of pincers, a tool used for gripping and carrying pieces of hot metal. "How is it, being in this room?" one of the interrogators asked. Shin did not know what to say. "I'll ask you just one more time," the chief interrogator said. "What were your father, mother, and brother planning to do after their escape?"
I really don't know," Shin replied.
"If you tell the truth right now, I'll save you. If not, I'll kill you. Understand?" Shin remembers paralyzing confusion. "I've been easy on you until now because you're a kid," the interrogator said. "Don't try my patience." Again, Shin failed to reply. "This son of a bitch won't do," the chief interrogator shouted. The chief's lieutenant surrounded Shin and pulled off his clothes. Shackles were locked around his ankles and tied to the chain that hung from the ceiling. The winch started up, pulling Shin off his feet. His head hit the floor with a thud. His hands were bound together with a rope that was threaded through a hook on the ceiling. When the trussing was done, his body formed a U, his face and feet toward the ceiling, his bare back toward the floor. The chief interrogator shouted more questions. Shin remembers giving no coherent answers. The chief told one of his men to fetch something. A tub full of burning charcoal was dragged beneath Shin. One of the interrogators used a bellows to stoke the coals. The winch lowered Shin toward the flames. "Keep going until he talks," the chief said. Shin, crazed with pain, smelling his burning flesh, twisted away from the heat. One of the guards grabbed a gaff hook from the wall and pierced the boy in the lower abdomen, holding him over the fire until he lost consciousness. He awoke in his cell.
Guards had dressed him in his ill-fitting prison outfit, which he'd soiled with excrement and urine. He had no idea how long he had lain unconscious on the floor. His lower back was blistered and sticky with discharge. The flesh around his ankles had been scraped away. For 2 days, Shin managed to crawl around in his cell and to eat. Guards brought him whole steamed ears of corn, along with corn porridge and cabbage soup. But as his burns became infected, he grew feverish, lost his appetite, and found it nearly impossible to move. Seeing Shin curled up on the floor of his cell, a guard shouted in the prison hallway, "That little runt is really tough." Shin guesses 10 days came and went before his final interrogation. It took place in his cell because he was too weak to get up off the floor. But he was no longer afraid. For the first time, he found words to defend himself. "I was the one who reported this," he said. "I did a good job." His interrogators didn't believe him. But instead of threatening or hurting Shin, they asked questions. He explained all that he had heard in his mother's house and what he had said to the night guard at school. He begged his interrogators to talk to Hong Sung Jo, the classmate who could confirm the story. They promised nothing and left his cell. Shin's fever grew worse. Blisters on his back swelled with pus. His cell smelled so bad that guards refused to step inside. After several days, though the exact amount of time is unclear, as Shin was drifting in and out of delirium, guards opened his cell door and ordered 2 prisoners to go in. They picked him up and carried him down the corridor to another cell. Guards locked Shin inside. There was another prisoner in the cell. Shin had been granted a reprieve. Hong had confirmed his story. Shin would never see the school's night guard again. Chapter 7. The Sun Shines Even on Mouse Holes. By the standards of Camp 14, Shin's cellmate was notably old, somewhere around 50. He refused to explain why he was locked up in the camp's underground prison. But he did say he had been there for many years and that he sorely missed the sun. Pallid, leathery skin sagged over his fleshless bones. His name was Kim Jin Myung. He asked to be called Uncle. Shin was in no condition to say much of anything for several weeks. Fever kept him curled up on the cold floor, where he expected to die. He could not eat and told his cellmate to take his food. Uncle ate some of it, but only until the boy's appetite returned. In the meantime, Uncle went to work as Shin's full-time nurse. He turned mealtimes into thrice-daily medical treatments, using a wooden spoon as a squeegee on Shin's infected blisters. "There's a lot of pus here," he told Shin. "I'm going to scrape it away, so bear with me." He rubbed salty cabbage soup into the wounds as a disinfectant. He massaged Shin's arms and legs so that his muscles would not atrophy. To prevent urine and feces from coming into contact with the boy's wounds, he carried the cell's chamber pot to Shin and hoisted him up so he could use it. Shin guesses that this intensive care went on for about 2 months. He had a sense that Uncle had done this kind of work before, judging from his competence and calm. On occasion, Shin and Uncle could hear the screams and moans of a prisoner being tortured. The room with the winch and the clubs seemed to be just down the corridor. Prison rules banned inmates from talking, but in their cell, which was just large enough for Shin and Uncle to lie side by side, they could whisper. Shin discovered later that guards knew about these conversations. Uncle seemed to Shin to have special standing with the guards. They cut his hair and lent him scissors so he could trim his beard. They brought him cups of water. They told him the time of day when he asked. They gave him extra food, much of which he shared with Shin. "Kid, you have a lot of days to live," Uncle said. "They say the sun shines even on mouse holes." The old man's medical skills and his caring words kept the boy alive. His fever waned, his mind cleared, and his burns congealed into scars. It was Shin's first exposure to sustained kindness, and he was grateful beyond words. But he also found it puzzling. He had not trusted his mother to keep him from starving. At school, he trusted no one, with the possible exception of Hong Sung Jo, and informed on everyone. In return, he expected abuse and betrayal. In the cell, Uncle slowly reconfigured these expectations. The old man said he was lonely, and and seemed genuinely happy to share his space and his meals with someone else. He never once angered or frightened Shin or undermined his recovery. The routines of prison life following Shin's interrogation and torture, discounting the screaming that periodically echoed down the prison corridor, were oddly sustaining. Although the food was tasteless, guards delivered enough of it for Shin and Uncle to survive. There was no dangerous outside labor, no exhausting work quotas. For the first time in his life, Shin wasn't expected to do any physical labor. Other than nursing the boy, Uncle was a man of leisure. He exercised daily in his cell. He cut Shin's hair. He was an entertaining talker whose knowledge of North Korea thrilled Shin, especially when the subject was food. "Uncle, tell me a story," Shin would say. The old man described what food outside the fence looked, smelled, and tasted like. Thanks to his loving descriptions of roasting pork, boiling chicken, and eating clams at the seashore, Shin's appetite came back with a vengeance. As his health improved, guards began to call him out of the cell. They were now very much aware that Shin had snitched on his own family. They pressed him to inform on the old man. "You two are in there together," a guard said to Shin. "What does he say? Don't conceal anything." Back in the cell, Uncle wanted to know, "What did they ask you?" Squeezed between his nurse and his jailers, Shin elected to tell the truth to both sides. He told Uncle that the guards had asked him to be an informer. This did not surprise the old man. He continued to entertain Shin with long stories about good things to eat, but he did not volunteer biographical information. He would not talk about his family. He expressed no opinions about the government. Shin guessed, based on the way Uncle used language, that he had once been an important and well-educated man, but it was only a guess. Although it was a crime to talk about escaping from Camp 14, it was not against the rules to fantasize about what life would be like if the government were to set you free. Uncle told Shin that both of them would one day be released. Until then, he said, they had a sacred obligation to stay strong, live as long as possible, and never consider suicide. "What do you think?" Uncle would then ask Shin. "Do you believe I'll also be able to make it out?" Shin doubted it, but said nothing. A guard unlocked the door of Shin's cell and handed him the school uniform he had worn on the day he arrived in the underground prison. "Put on these clothes and come along quickly," the guard said. As Shin changed, he asked Uncle what would happen. The old man assured him that he would be safe and that they would meet again on the outside. "Let me hold you once," he said, grasping both of Shin's hands tightly. Shin did not want to leave the cell. He had never trusted, never loved anyone before. In the years ahead, he would think of the old man in the dark room far more often and with far greater affection than he thought of his parents. But after guards let him out of the cell and locked its door, he never saw Uncle again. Chapter 8. Avoiding Mother's Eyes. They took Shin to the big bare room where, in early April, he had first been interrogated. Now it was late November. Shin had just turned 14. He had not seen the sun for more than half a year. What he did see in the room startled him. His father knelt in front of two interrogators who sat at their desks. He seemed much older and more careworn than before. He had been brought into the underground prison at about the same time as Shin. Kneeling beside him, Shin saw that his father's right leg canted outward in an unnatural way. Shin Young-sub had also been tortured. Below his knee, his leg bones had been broken, and they had knitted back together at an odd angle. The injury would end his relatively comfortable job as a camp mechanic and lathe operator. He would now have to hobble around as an unskilled laborer on a construction crew. During his time in the underground prison, guards told Shin's father that his youngest son had informed them of the escape plan. When Shin later had a chance to talk to his father about this, the conversation was strained. His father said it was better to have told the guards than to have risked concealing the plan. But his caustic tone confused Shin. He sounded as if he knew his son's first instinct was to inform. "Read it and stamp it," one of the interrogators said, handing a document to Shin and one to his father. It was a non-disclosure form, stipulating that father and son would not tell anyone what had gone on inside the prison. If they did talk, the document said, they would be punished. After pressing their ink thumbs to their respective forms, they were handcuffed, blindfolded, and led outside to the elevator. Above ground, their cuffs and blindfolds still on, they were guided into the back seat of a small car and driven away. In the car, Shin guessed that he and his father would be released back into the camp's population. Guards would not force them to sign a secrecy pledge and then shoot them. It did not make sense. But when the car stopped after about 30 minutes and his blindfold was removed, he panicked. A crowd had gathered at the empty wheat field near his mother's house. This was the place where Shin had witnessed 2 or 3 executions a year since he was a toddler. A makeshift gallows had been constructed, and a wooden pole had been driven into the ground. Shin was now certain that he and his father were to be executed. He became acutely aware of the air passing into and out of his lungs. He told himself these were the last breaths of his life. His panic subsided when a guard barked out his father's name. "Hey, Kyung-sub, go sit at the very front." Shin was told to go with his father. A guard removed their handcuffs. They sat down. The officer overseeing the execution began to speak. Shin's mother and brother were dragged out. Shin had not seen them or heard anything about their fate since he walked out of his mother's house on the night he betrayed them.
"Execute Jang Hee-gyun and Shin Hee-gyun, traitors of the people," the senior officer said.
Shin looked at his father. He was weeping silently. The shame Shin feels about the executions has been compounded over the years by the lies he began telling in South Korea. "There is nothing in my life to compare with this burden," Shin told me on the day in California when he explained how and why he had misrepresented his past. But he was not ashamed on the day of the executions. He was angry. He hated his mother and brother with the savage clarity of a wronged and wounded adolescent. As he saw it, he had been tortured and nearly died, and his father had been crippled because of their foolish, self-centered scheming. And only minutes before he saw them on the execution grounds, Shin had believed he would be shot because of their recklessness. When guards dragged her to the gallows, Shin saw that his mother looked bloated. They forced her to stand on a wooden box, gagged her, tied her arms behind her back, and tightened a noose around her neck. They did not cover her swollen eyes. She scanned the crowd and found Shin. He refused to hold her gaze. When guards pulled away the box, she jerked about desperately. As he watched his mother struggle, Shin thought she deserved to die. Shin's brother looked gaunt and frail as guards tied him to the wooden post. 3 guards fired their rifles 3 times. Bullets snapped the rope that held his forehead to the pole. It was a bloody, brain-splattered mess of a killing, a spectacle that sickened and frightened Shin. But he thought his brother, too, had deserved it.